Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Nelson Mandela change South Africa and the world, and how did his own vision for achieving equal rights under South African law evolve over his long and remarkable life of public activism? Jailed for 27 years for his role in ANC sabotage of pro-apartheid targets, Mandela emerged from prison in 1990 to become South Africa's first black president, with the extraordinary challenge of leading his country out of an excruciating era of minority rule and apartheid. Martin Meredith is a journalist, biographer, and historian. He chronicles Mandela's life from his early education at a Methodist mission school through his presidency and retirement from public life. His new book is called Mandela, A Biography. Martin, welcome to Think.
Good to be with you.
You opened the book with a fascinating snapshot of Mandela's temperament, which, of course, is far more complex than the sort of benign superhuman we sometimes see in the media. Can you talk a little bit about the man who walked out of prison after those 27 years in confinement?
Well, he's a man who, when he walked out of prison, was something of a legend around the world. But in fact, very few people knew anything very much about him. He'd been absent for 27 years in prison, and indeed nobody even knew what he looked like. The last photograph that had been taken of him was taken in 1964. So even his appearance was strange. But he was, when he came out, because of the anti-apartheid movement which had grown in South Africa and abroad, he had become a legend. Songs had been written about him. Streets had been named after him. Governments had given him awards, and universities too. But when he came out, he was a very different person from the man who went in. When he went in, he was he was middle-aged. He first went to a prison when he was only 42 years old. But he was rather impetuous, stubborn, passionate, and taken to sort of making decisions which, on the whole, got him into quite a lot of trouble. What he always says is that prison. What he says is that prison matured him. He matured in prison, and he came out with a much quieter, more determined character. He'd become an intensely private person. He tended to hide his emotions behind a mask. In prison, he acquired a sort of grip of self-control. Discipline became hugely important. It became the way that basically he was to survive prison. But all that changed when he came out. When he came out, he was a different character, more wiser, I suppose.
And you've written compellingly in the past, you know, we sort of assume that it was a foregone conclusion that he became this heroic figure over that time. But you've compared the sort of parallel tracks of Nelson Mandela and then over in Zimbabwe of Robert Mugabe, who has taken a very different direction with his own leadership.
Oh, yes. Mandela in prison understood that if he was to achieve his objective, and his objective was basically to establish a non-racial democracy in South Africa, what he believed before he went into prison was that violence would achieve that objective. That is, if he was engaged in a campaign of sabotage and targeted violence, that would probably cause the government to fall. Robert Mugabe in neighboring Zimbabwe was also someone who took up the cause of violence and essentially went to war to overthrow white rule. But whereas Mandela believed in prison that the way to achieve his objective was through negotiation, Robert Mugabe always had a liking for violence. What he was after was military victory. Mandela recognized that in South Africa, it was not really going to be possible to achieve military victory, and that any, as it were, attempts to to achieve a military victory would cause endless havoc and ruin, basically, for the country. So Mandela, and indeed it was a sign of his extraordinary leadership, was that while he was in prison, he himself, on his own account, and indeed against the advice of his own closest friends in prison, endeavored to open negotiations with the white government, with the white politicians who were running the government. And he was rebuffed for several years. But eventually, it was that decision by him to open negotiations with the government which led to the white politicians trusting him and believing that he was somebody whom they could, in fact, negotiate with. And so there was a marked contrast between Mandela and Mugabe. They, in some ways, they were quite similar in that Mandela spent 27 years in prison and Mugabe spent 11 years in prison. And they had similar upbringings, but they turned out to be completely different characters. Mandela achieved a phenomenal victory by winning democracy for South Africa. Mugabe went on to ruin his own country.
Let's step back here and get a little bit about Mandela's early life. He was born in 1918, 30 years before apartheid was made official law, and educated in Methodist mission schools. What kind of influence did his teachers there have on his view of the world?
Well, the mission schools, they were run by Christian missionaries who had a fairly kind of strict view of the world. And indeed, since most of them had come from Britain, they believed that British values and instructions in education were the best. And Mandela grew up in mission schools, believing that British values were the best. And indeed, he followed a fairly kind of privileged route. That he was related to a paramount chief in his local area in the Transkei, which is in the southeast of South Africa. And because of that, he was elevated, if you like, through school, through primary school to secondary school. And he eventually won a coveted place at a university, which was the only institution in the whole of Southern Africa which allowed black students to win degrees. So he had a privileged upbringing, and it was pretty orthodox that he grew up respectful of Christianity, respectful of white authority, and respectful also of the chiefly traditions. He, by observing his own relatives and how they operated the chiefly system.
Interestingly, it was when he was at university that his sort of political awakening took hold, and ultimately he was asked to leave.
Well, it was a sign of his rather impetuous nature at that time that because he achieved a place at university, he was destined to become one of a very small elite. He'd had a his future was almost kind of mapped out for him, but his guardian, who was this paramount chief, decided to arrange a marriage for him, and Mandela was willing to give up his privileged position at university. And he fled. He fled from an arranged marriage and went on an escapade and ended up in Johannesburg with no money, no connections, and his promising future more or less in ruins.
Can you talk about how he came to embrace the ideas of Gandhi and nonviolent resistance, at least in his early life?
Well, Gandhi had quite an influence First of all, on the Indian population resident in South Africa. And the early political protests by the Indian community in South Africa had a considerable impact on other forms of political protest. And at the University of Fort Hare, which Mandela attended, and in other areas, the influence of Gandhi and his sort of non-violent approach to political activity was highly regarded and followed, certainly in the Indian community, and also partly by those in the African community who were engaged in political activity. And there was no question at the time that Mandela was a young man, born in 1918, he ended up in Johannesburg in the early 1940s, in his early 20s. There was no question then of any violent challenge to the South African government and to the white-run government. And so normal political protest, that is, petitions and deputations and various forms of other campaigning, were all based on non-violent approach. The violent approach, or the decision to head for a sort of violent campaign, came much later.
Yeah, the ANC remained nonviolent until the Sharpeville massacre. Can you talk about what happened there?
Well, the Sharpeville massacre, there were various forms of protest going on during the 1950s. One of the main banes of life for Africans in South Africa was the pass law system, which meant that pretty well all Africans had to carry a pass, which was an identity document. They could be stopped in the street and asked for it by any passing policeman. And if they didn't have the right documents, they could be expelled from the areas in which they were living, or they could be fined, or they could be imprisoned. It was a pernicious system. There were political protests against the pass system. And one opposition party, a black opposition party called the Pan-African Congress, which was a rival to the African National Congress to which Mandela belonged, decided to hold an anti-pass demonstration in a small town called Sharpeville, which was in the southern Transvaal, as it was called. And it was started off as a relatively peaceful protest. But the crowd of protesters got bigger and bigger, and a few stones were hurled at a sort of police. And then the police panicked and opened fire on the protesters, and most of them turned and ran away. But nearly 70 people were killed, most of them shot in the back, and it became more or less the... It was an episode which stained South Africa permanently. It was a sort of became a permanent monument to the evils of apartheid. Nothing like this had happened in South Africa during the early years of apartheid. And this slaughter which took place, and slaughter was what it really was, stunned the world and began the anti-apartheid movement in the rest of the world, both in the United States and in Europe, really can be traced back to that one particular incident.
Martin Meredith is with us. He is a journalist, biographer, and historian. We're talking this hour about his book, Mandela, A Biography. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can distinguish yourself professionally and personally. Evening classes are available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Martin Meredith. We're speaking about his book, Mandela, A Biography. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So in 1961, Martin, Mandela took over leadership of the ANC's militant wing. Can you talk for a minute about how they chose their targets and what they were trying to achieve by arming themselves?
Well, Mandela believed that by picking certain kind of targets like power lines or government offices or post offices or police stations, that he would persuade the government that rather than face a sort of permanent campaign of violence, that they should enter negotiations to end apartheid. Mandela had no experience of sabotage or guerrilla warfare had no military experience, nor did hardly anybody else in the military wing of the ANC that he set up. They were little more than a bunch of amateurs, and they achieved virtually nothing by embarking on a military campaign. They didn't kill, very few people were killed as a result, and indeed they tried to avoid direct casualties. The aim was to sabotage certain kind of government installations and institutions, but nothing really happened that threatened the government at all. It was more of an irritant. And it was, on the whole, it was a disastrous move. It enabled the government to take action against the ANC and its militants in the name of law and order. And they were all eventually rounded up. Many were sentenced to, like Mandela, were sentenced to life imprisonment. And the result was that opposition to the government just collapsed instantly. There was nothing, there was more or less silence from the black population for at least 10 years or more. So the decision to commit the ANC to a campaign of violence was futile, and it had a counterproductive effect.
What was Mandela's life like in Robben Island, which is the prison that he spent the majority of his sentence at?
It was pretty grim to start off with. The aim of the prison staff was to break the morale of prisoners, and they used every method that was available to them. Mandela himself was never physically assaulted, but physical assaults were common. He was treated with a certain degree of deference, but the conditions, the early conditions in which he lived, were harsh in the extreme. That is, was that he was forced to undergo hard labor. He worked into a lime quarry, where they were subjected to the harsh glare of the sun for hours on end. They were prevented from having sunglasses, for example. The food was atrocious. The hardships were really quite severe. Transgressions of any rules or regulations were punished by withdrawal of food and all kinds of other impositions. So the early years on Robben Island were extremely unpleasant. They became, by gradual process, they improved. And a great deal of that had to do with Mandela's leadership on the island, that he set out to try and persuade the prison authorities to improve their circumstances, to allow, for example, study facilities. And he won very small battles initially, but one sort of triumph was enough to raise the morale of all the prisoners, the political prisoners who were there. And gradually, he was able to negotiate a much better regime than what he was faced with when he first went there. So after about 10 years or so, conditions started to improve. The interesting thing about Mandela's experience of prison, and indeed the experience of the other prisoners who were on Robben Island, is that they did not regard those years spent in prison as wasted. It was because they were able to engage in studies. They had some sort of objective. They formed a community there, which, because they were all there fighting for a cause which they believed to be just, sort of was reinforced their determination to kind of come out of it, to win, basically. And what was so remarkable about Mandela, indeed the others when they came out of prison, was the way in which they described it in unexpected terms. Mandela, on the day after he stepped out of prison, said that it was a rewarding experience. What that they had learned there, the comradeship, the ability to learn, to study, and so on, all impressed them. And indeed, only a year or so, Mandela was remarking on the fact that he'd heard many of his comrades say that the period that they spent on Robben Island was the best time of their lives. And he went on to say, when he thought about that, he said it was because it was more like a close-knit family and a university than a prison. And many other prisoners have remarked on the same phenomenon of prison. They were a band of brothers in prison, and they believed that they won because they had improved their conditions. Many of them came out with university degrees. Most of them relished the comradeship of those years in prison. So it was, in the end, I think they regarded their emerging from prison as something of a triumph rather than a punishment.
Martin Meredith is my guest. We're talking about his book, Mandela, A Biography. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go first to Richard in Fort Worth. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I'm doing great, thank you. I'll go ahead and give you my comment?
Please do.
Okay. The idea is that, you know, frankly, as a common everyday person that I am, I don't know a lot about the apartheid situation in South Africa, but I, you know, of course, some of the basic facts, of course. Nelson Mandela, obviously, being a strong leadership to help the nation out of that. But my comment is much more general, and I feel like in discussing some of these details about the leadership of Nelson Mandela to extricate his country from this unequal situation, especially the particular minority people oppressed in South Africa, that it's just the same story told over and over again in various countries or various situations, not unlike the situation that developed in the United States during the 60s. Certainly, there is something to be said for using the system to bring about a more lasting kind of mediation or correction of the situation, but it's a fairly common human flaw that the majority is going to oppress a minority. And that's what really gets me, I guess, is the fact that it continues over and over again. And, I mean, it doesn't even need to be a substantial difference between the people. It can be as different as hair color or eye color.
Yeah, Richard, I understand your point is very interesting, although the case in South Africa, of course, is that it was a very small minority oppressing a majority. Do you want to talk about that, Martin?
Well, yes. I mean, the white minority, South Africa gained independence in 1910 under white minority rule. And the white rule was regarded as being the only system which was going to function. regardless. The apartheid system was it was a far more repressive system than what appeared in the United States let's say in the 1950s. Laws were enforced to ensure that the black population was relegated to a subservient position. The apartheid system, which really sort of began to be put in place in 1948, tried to separate white and black on an almost total basis. So everything from employment to education to park benches to traveling in buses and so on, everything was segregated. And the punishment and so on for transgressing the apartheid laws and rules was pretty severe on the whole. It was the most elaborate system of racial segregation that has ever been put in place anywhere in the world. It was this enormous edifice which was basically designed to keep the black population subservient. So that was what Mandela was up against. The apartheid system was during the 1960s, the 1970s, and indeed even during the 1980s, was believed to be more or less indestructible. And it was to the as a result of the action taken by the anti-apartheid protesters by people like Mandela in prison that eventually brought the system down. The difference between South Africa's apartheid regime and any other system of racial segregation or indeed other forms of discrimination which go on in the world is really kind of quite marked.
Can you speak, Martin, about the relationship that developed and the negotiations that took place between the still imprisoned Mandela by now at Polsmoor and F.W. de Klerk, who was president of South Africa?
Well, Mandela started his attempts at negotiation while there was another president in place, a man called P.W. Botha. And who was an old hardline, staunch kind of apartheid supporter, determined that the whites would continue to rule forevermore. It was Mandela's persistence in trying to open negotiations that led to a whole series of secret meetings between him and government officials, which went on for a period of 3 or 4 years, until eventually he was given an opportunity to speak to President Botha or to meet him in his office. And that was an event which marked it was a transformation, really, because previously Mandela had been dismissed by the president as nothing more than a communist terrorist running a terrorist organization. So the fact of accepting Mandela, accepting a meeting with Mandela, he was taken from his prison confines to the president's office. That changed the politics and the dynamics of the situation quite considerably. Botha then resigned shortly afterwards, and another president was elected, F.W. de Klerk, and it was de Klerk, whom Mandela continued negotiations with, and their relationship was cordial at times, but fractious more often than not. And it took Mandela and de Klerk 4 years, before they came to an agreement about what the future of South Africa was going to be.
How much of an influence was, certainly there was international government pressure, there was private commercial divestiture from investment in South Africa. Was that a factor in de Klerk's decision?
There were many factors in de Klerk's decision. Sanctions were imposed by numerous countries in the West against South Africa. But those were costly measures rather than punitive ones. one of the big factors influencing de Klerk was the demise of communism and the fall of the Berlin Wall, which occurred in 1989. And the white regime in South Africa had long been convinced that they were the target, if you like, of communist infiltration. And they believed that the communists were bent on trying to gain control of South Africa. So when the when communism in Eastern Europe collapsed, it removed one of their greatest fears. And they believed also, de Klerk believed also, that he would be able to outmaneuver Mandela and still retain power with a coalition of, if you like, anti-ANC collaborators. But external pressure was important in many ways. South Africa was it was banned from participation in international sporting events, for example, and that was quite damaging to white morale. The white South Africans didn't want to be regarded anymore as pariahs. They wanted to open links with the outside world, and they couldn't do that other than by releasing Mandela and opening negotiations with the African National Congress. So Western pressure was important, but Western leaders continued to press de Klerk and other apartheid leaders to change, to agree to open up democracy, basically. So it was an important factor.
Martin Meredith is my guest. We're speaking this hour about his book, Mandela, A Biography. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can distinguish yourself professionally and personally. Evening classes are available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist, biographer, and historian Martin Meredith. We're speaking about his book, Mandela, A Biography. If you've got a question, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Martin, as extraordinary as it is one thing to survive that time in prison, to be elected president finally by a people who have been waiting for a long time for your leadership. It is quite another to make that transition as, relatively speaking, peaceful as it turned out to be. What did Mandela lay out for himself when he was trying to figure out how he was going to accomplish this?
You mean when he became president or
yes.
Before he became president?
Well, I suppose we need to skip ahead because we've got 15 minutes left in the program.
Once he became president, the task that he faced was enormous. That he had the whole of South Africa had been built on the basis of ensuring, if you like, white prosperity and power, and everything from, except for Parliament and the National Assembly, which was filled with black representatives as the result of the election in 1994, pretty well all the main institutions of government and society, that is that the civil service, the defense forces, local municipalities, city governments, and so on, they're all staffed at a senior level by whites. And all this had to be transformed. And it was a monumental task on its own. But what made it even more difficult is that Mandela's victory at the polls in 1994 had raised black expectations. And there was a great deal of impatience amongst blacks to see the changes that they wanted on employment and housing and electricity and sanitation and good water supplies and so on. So the demands on Mandela were enormous. I mean, he was, by that time, in his 70s, he had already fought one enormous battle for most of his life, basically. He'd spent 50 years as a political activist attempting to overthrow apartheid and succeeding. And then when he became president in 1994, he was then faced with this enormous task. And it was particularly difficult because of all the racial friction that there was as a result of apartheid and the fears that the white community had that there might be, that they were basically going to be on the receiving end of any new government. So Mandela actually had to go out of his way, and he did so in a very extraordinary way, to ensure that the white population was carried along with all these momentous changes that he believed had to be instituted. So he had an impatient black electorate to deal with, a rather fearful white community to deal with, and pretty well all the real levers of power were still held by the whites, who were extremely nervous about what was going to happen next. And it's to his great credit that he managed in the period of 5 years to ensure that the transfer of power and the transitions were conducted in a relatively kind of peaceful way and an orderly way. He was not a particularly effective executive president. The government policy tended to kind of to drift, that decisions weren't made when they should be made. And he was as inclined at some times to take unwise decisions in his old age as he had been in the days of his youth. He was still inclined to be a bit impetuous. But on the whole, his years in office were relatively successful in getting to grips with the enormous problems that the country faced. And again, if you look back in retrospect now, that those 5 years in the 1990s when he was president, looking back now, most South Africans regard his time in office as being a time of hope and harmony, and certainly compared to the rather sad developments that have taken place in South Africa since.
Yeah, and interestingly, Thabo Mbeki was Mandela's chosen successor.
Well, Thabo Mbeki was chosen as Mandela's successor, but privately Mandela preferred another candidate. It was more that the African National Congress chose Mbeki, mm-hmm. And his leadership, I think, could be considered to be a disaster. He was particularly over the AIDS crisis and his refusal to do anything about it, which was taken on absurd ideological grounds. And indeed, there was a Harvard University report which came out last year which said that Mbeki's policies on AIDS had led to the premature death of 350,000 people. Now, it's a pretty severe indictment of a president of a country. And it's an extraordinary contrast to the Mandela years that I was describing, where things were so much more hopeful and harmonious.
And among those who died was Mandela's own son.
Yes, indeed. Mandela's son died from AIDS, and Mandela was quick to announce that the cause of his death, that it was AIDS, because in South Africa, partly because of Mbeki's refusal to acknowledge the crisis and what it was all about, AIDS was still a stigma. Well, it still is a stigma to some extent in South Africa. And it was not recognized, and people would prefer to be classified as having died from some other problem rather than to admit that they died from AIDS. So Mandela, acknowledging that his own son had died from AIDS, was trying to move the... enlighten people about the need to confront AIDS and to admit what was going on.
What would you identify as the greatest achievements and shortcomings of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
Well, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission had sort of multiple purposes. One of them was to try and discover what had happened to the death of a whole lot of political activists, death and murder of political activists in the past, or indeed those who'd been tortured. It was trying to come to terms with the violent conduct or South Africa's period of violence during the apartheid years. And that was not only violence by government agents, but also by the ANC and other political operators. It depends which perspective you come from when you're trying to make a judgment about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission as to what it achieved. It certainly didn't achieve much reconciliation, but then that probably was not attainable. You can't dig up murders and tortures and arson and terrible deeds from the past and hope that it will that people will come to terms with it easily. I don't think any country facing internal troubles of that kind does so. The scars of that kind of internal conflict remain for a very long time. But it nevertheless did provide a huge amount of evidence about the scale of the atrocities and indeed who was responsible for them. And I think that was probably its greatest achievement, that it uncovered a system of brutality and murder and coercion and violence on both sides, on all sides, in fact. And that helped public understanding of the past. And I think in the long term, that will be quite important in terms of reconciliation. It's always a danger for countries to hide their past, and countries tend to do that a great deal. The French, for example, still slowly coming to terms with what went on during Nazi occupation in the Second World War, even now, today. And it does help reconcile the past from the present, and that's important.
What sort of climate exists today in South Africa among people of different races? We've seen in this country that you can change the law, and then it takes a long time after that for people to really sort of embody that in their souls. But is progress being made as far as you can see?
Yes, to some extent. I mean, one of the great problems is the huge disparity in wealth.
Yeah.
The white population had used their years in power to acquire a very large degree of the wealth of the country. It was pretty well all in white hands, apart from a few enterprising black entrepreneurs. And that disparity in wealth still exists. So you have a wealthy white community. You now have a relatively wealthy black elite, but for the vast majority of black South Africans, they are pretty close to the breadline and have difficulty in finding employment, difficulty in feeding their kids, and finding good housing and living a reasonable job, and that probably is the this kind of disparity obviously goes on in different parts of the world. It's just that because of where South Africa has come from, because the whites have been an exclusive elite, gaining as much wealth as they possibly could over a prolonged period, the resentment and hostility towards whites, because of that wealth, is still there. So what you have is, if you like, on the whole, people have tried to, all communities have tried to get on with each other, but it can be quite superficial. And there is always the fear that just beneath the surface, these resentments and old memories and dislikes and hatreds could still sort of bubble up.
Mandela is 91 years old now. He has largely retired from any sort of public role. How is his health these days?
How is his health?
Yeah.
His health, for a 92-year-old man, he had a very long innings, and indeed was remarkably spry into all the way through his 80s. It's very heartening that a man who suffered so much personal hardship should have had an extended life where he was still active and able to enjoy an elderly life. So in his 80s, he was still pretty active. He's now, I think, in a declining quite fast. He made it, his last public appearance was in February when he joined a celebration of the fact that he'd been released from prison 20 years before. But I suspect that will probably be the last time that we will ever see Nelson Mandela in public again.
Clearly, his legacy is established. Are there things about who he is and what he stands for that he feels have not been adequately sort of addressed or publicized? Or is he pretty satisfied with the world's perception of him and his work and his values?
Around much of the world, he's regarded with almost kind of saint-like qualities. He's a bit puzzled by that because he regards himself as he describes himself, as an ordinary person, but confronted by extraordinary circumstances. I think he's greatly missed now in South Africa. His rather kind of benign presence, his thoughtfulness, his humor, his self-deprecating humor. There are many things which people miss about him. And I think around the world, his reputation on the whole has sort of gone passed into granite, really. I don't think his reputation around the world will ever be different. What interested me about writing the book was that I wanted to try and find out how much an individual, the Mandela himself, had contributed towards this huge change that had occurred in South Africa, the achievement of democracy, and how much had been attributed to the, if you like, to the anti-apartheid movement. And there's no doubt in my own mind that Mandela, without Mandela, I'm not sure that there would have been the transition to democracy, and certainly it wouldn't have taken place in such an effective way.
Martin Meredith is a journalist, biographer, and historian. His most recent book is called Mandela, A Biography. Martin, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.